Welcome to this post-interim report release media opportunity with our Return to Flight Task Group co-chairman, Dick Covey. Before we get started, I'd like to run through a couple of administrative announcements. First of all, we'd ask everybody on the loop to please mute your speakerphones or microphones when you're not speaking. For those who do not have mute capability on your instrument, if you'll press, and you don't have to do it right now because I'm going to do a roll call, but if you'll press star six, that will mute the phone, and then you can kind of run a little test after you mute it. We'll let you know if it's muted. And then star six again when you speak, we'll unmute it. What I'd like to do when we get to the questions and answers is call on everyone by name, and that'll make it go a little more quickly. We'll go through with a question and a follow-up and then go back through again, time permitting. With that, I think we're ready to just see who we've got, and so let me just run down the sheet I've got, and then if there's somebody else, we'll add you at the end. Marcia Dunn, are you with us?
Yes, I'm here. Can you hear me?
I can hear you fine.
Okay, I'm going to mute now.
Okay. Bill Harwood, Bill, are you?
Yeah, I'm here, Dave, loud and clear.
Okay. Dave Santucci?
Yep, I'm here.
Got you, Dave. Tracy Watson, are you with us?
Yep.
Hi, Tracy.
Hi, Dave. Thanks.
Gwyneth Shaw?
Yes, I'm here.
Hi, Gwyneth. Gina Treadgold, are you with us? Okay, we don't have Gina yet. Frank Mooring?
I'm here.
Hey, Frank. Todd, I heard you earlier. Are you still with us, Todd?
Present.
Okay. Earl Lane?
Yes, I'm here.
Hi, Earl. Mark Corot?
Yes, Dave.
Hey, Mark. Warren Leary?
I'm present.
Hey, Warren. Brad Liston?
I'm here.
Hi, Brad. And let's see, who else might we have on board with us today? Okay. Don't hear any other media on board, and so with that, I'll turn it over to Mr. Covey.
Dick? Good morning or good afternoon, depending upon where you are. Today, the Return to Flight Task Group released their second interim report. Report is a kind of a line in the sand, if you would, relative to our last public meeting held on April 16th. So it doesn't document anything that may have occurred since then, but basically reflects what we discussed and deliberated at that public meeting and in the plenary session that preceded it here in Houston. Our intent is that we will probably have one additional interim report before we issue our final report, which, as you will recall, is due to the NASA administrator no later than 1 month before the flight of STS-114. Currently, to us, that means we're planning on having that report done by early February at the latest, based upon the current planning date for the next space shuttle flight. A reminder that the Return to Flight Task Group is chartered to provide an independent assessment to the NASA administrator of the implementation by the agency of those recommendations identified by the Columbia Accident Investigation Board that were deemed return to flight recommendations. That is the focus of our activities and our charter. There are many other activities that are ongoing related to preparing the shuttle and the agency for return to flight that are not necessarily associated with the CABE's recommendations. We as a task group are not necessarily assessing those activities nor fact-finding relative to those. One of the signs of progress that the agency has made since our first interim report is the fact that we have brought to closure our assessment of three of the recommendations of the CAPE. Those specifically are related to the reinforced carbon-carbon non-destructive inspection, two-person closeout, and an updating of the NASA, and as it was described at that time, NEMA, now NGA, a memorandum of agreement. relative to the other items that have been addressed by ENC, as we stated in our public meeting, there has been substantial progress across the board relative to all the return of flight recommendations. With that, I think I'm ready to take questions, Dave.
Okay. Why don't we just run down the list and begin with Marcia Dunn, Associated Press.
Hi, can you hear me? Hello?
Yeah, we can hear you, Marcia.
Okay, great. Mr. Covey, I noticed in the report release today that there's some talk about thinning the garden for NASA to focus more on the most promising alternatives for inspection and repairing TPS, and also that there seems to be the greatest risk to compliance with the scheduled return to flight date is the inspection and repair. Can you sort of give a status? Is it the inspection boom that's causing the most heartburn here? And based on what you know today, is it possible for NASA to get all this in order to meet a March 05 launch date?
Let's see. You know, the primary method that is being addressed right now to complete the inspection of the orbiter leading edge system is by use of a boom extension and a sensor package that is on that boom extension. We clearly, in a report, identify that as being the highest risk item relative to the current schedule. The approach to not just how to deal with the boom, but also to understand the capabilities of the sensor package and to make the capabilities of the sensor package adequate enough to detect critical damage size, which is still being evolved, is very challenging given the current schedule. What the agency has to do is eventually is find the point at which they're going to be comfortable that they can meet the March-April timeframe with that particular approach to assessing damage to the leading-edge system, or to come up with other alternatives that would meet the intent of the CAVE's recommendation. So they continue to work both avenues, with the primary focus being on developing the boom and making sure that the sensor package that will be on the end of the boom can detect the critical damage size that will be determined through the ongoing testing.
Well, do you really, I mean, from what you know today, is this feasible to accomplish all this in time to fly next spring?
We don't know of any reason that it's not. Given the data and the information that's been provided to us, but it is there is risk, you know, involved with it. It's a technological challenge, and it's technology is being developed for a specific application. So the risk is in that they come up with something along the way of the development activity that precludes them from being successful and using that approach to determine damage.
Okay, thank you.
Bill Harwood.
Yeah, hi. I kind of along similar lines, I was struck by the last paragraph of the summary of the report, which said that on-orbit inspection repair remain necessary to reduce risk, but should one or both of those capabilities not be fully developed by return to flight, the ability of the crew to await rescue on the ISS becomes an important consideration. What do you mean by that? I mean, in other words, if they've got safe haven fully developed and the station stocked with supplies or something, you're saying, I mean, can I read that as you don't have to have the repair capability to fly?
Let's see. The approach right now is that the recommendation of the CABE was that they have the ability to inspect and repair, and that's the approach being taken by the agency. There are technological challenges to being able to accomplish that, and because of those technical challenges, we believe that there's a possibility that alternatives will have to be assessed if they can't meet the full intent of the CABE recommendation. Safe haven may be one of those alternatives. Right now, safe haven is only being addressed by the space shuttle program as a contingency type of capability, which means that you don't have to do a whole lot of analysis and you don't have to do as much analysis and planning as you would if it was a planned on way of dealing with a damage that may not be repairable. So we have, as we said last time, after our previous plenary session, have added the safe haven activity is one that we're going to continue to assess, just so we're up to speed on where they are relative to that capability, how they might use it, whether it's as a contingency or if it becomes a part of a planned activity.
If I can ask one, can I ask the second one, Dave?
Sure.
Yeah, the second one is just the relative challenge. You say that the sensor booming package is the primary challenge of RTF, but where do you think they stand in your view on the tank and foam shedding in general?
Well, in general, I believe they understand the areas of the tank that they need to address how foam is applied. They have developed the techniques required to apply the foam and are in the process of doing that. The testing, non-destructive testing of the newly applied foam continues to be an area that they're working on. But relatively, the technology required to fix the tank is more mature than the technology required to complete successful inspection and repair. So from that standpoint, it's a driver in terms of how long it's going to take to get the tank ready, but not so much from the technological or technical challenges that support that.
Thank you very much.
Okay. Dave Santucci.
Yeah, I wanted to go down the road of the tank just a little bit more. When are you expecting for the tank to be fully ready and delivered? And I guess I had heard that, I mean, essentially stopping the foam from coming off the tank is not an option, and that, keeping the size of the foam down is really the objective here. What size is the limit that you're looking at, and are you able to keep it under the new limits that you've set?
Well, let's see. We don't assess schedules, and I'm not. I can't tell you right now. I think it's when the tank is supposed to be delivered. I think that's something you could get from the space shuttle program pretty easily, and I'd ask that you go there to get those types of dates. Also, there's a continual effort underway to understand the nature and size of critical debris from the external tank. That's what led to the current requirement to expand the area of concern on the tank that led to the delay in being able to prepare the tank for a shipment. And that work continues. It's rather impressive, the amount of integrated data collection through computational fluid dynamics techniques that has been generated. There's millions and millions of runs that have been made to understand the source of debris that might hit the external tank. I'm sorry, hit the leading edge of the orbiter or other critical thermal protection system elements, and the size of that debris that would cause critical damage. It's a multi-step thing. One is you have to understand what the critical damage could be. That work is underway. They continue to develop the understanding of what critical damage is, and then backing that into the flow around the tank and the orbiter to understand sources of debris, and then understand what size debris would cause critical damage from any particular point on the tank. That work continues, and they're getting smarter and smarter about that. And as they get smarter, then they have to change they may have to change the areas of the tank that they have concern about.
I guess as a follow-up, I mean, is there, I mean, you didn't mention any specific size, so maybe you haven't come to a conclusion. Are you going to set a limit so that, you know, if you see a certain size come off of the tank on STS-114 or any of the following missions, that you're going to have to go back and, you know, figure out how to reduce the size?
Let's see. The approach right now that the program is taking is that they will understand the critical size. The critical size and critical debris size, and be able to verify through either analysis or non-destructive testing that size debris will not come off of the area of tanks of concern. Now, the real proof of that, and one of the risks, is that until you fly it in the actual flight environment, you won't have demonstrated that you've really addressed and fixed the problem. So flight test eventually becomes the ultimate test that you have to endure. The approach is to err on the side of conservatism relative to critical debris size, so that there is some margin then if debris should unexpectedly be larger than expected. So the approach is to be able to verify the integrity of the tank relative to critical debris in the right areas, the areas that could cause impact with the leading edge systems of the thermal protection system and other critical elements of the thermal protection system, and then to validate, or if you would, or to verify that through flight tests. So there's a lot to be said for data collection during the early flights, which is one of the recommendations, or some of the recommendations of the CABE actually address that, as well as the desire to not only know if you have critical damage, but also to understand if the tank thermal protection system performed as expected relative to shedding debris, and to document that as part of the first couple of flights, at least. But as we said in our report, you may not know the full capabilities of the tank relative to debris shedding for the rest of the shuttle's life. We'll continue to collect data.
Okay, let's see. Tracy Watson. Gwyneth, are you still with us?
I am still here. Excuse me. I was just curious, you mentioned when talking about the development of the boom and the TPS repair things, that at some point the program's going to have to decide whether they're comfortable with it or whether they're going to have to look at other things for the first flight. Has there been dialogue so far about where that point might be in terms of deciding whether or not to keep postponing the launch or to go ahead with something else?
No. You know, right now, the primary approach, and it's supported with little margin, is to develop the boom and use that as the inspection capability.
Did you have a follow-up, Gina?
Well, I'm just curious because you particularly mentioned that that the program's going to have to define the point where they're comfortable to meet the schedule. I'm just trying to figure out if there's sort of a deadline that's been set, either formally or informally, to sort of make that call.
Not that I'm aware of.
Okay, sorry about that, Gwyneth. Gina, did you join us? Okay, Frank Mooring.
Yes, thank you. On the boom inspection versus inspection from the space station, I'm starting to get a little bit lost on what the sequence is. Is the need to inspect and repair from the station, And if not, is the boom capable of doing that work autonomously, like in a shortfall or something like that?
Let me pause 1 second here to be sure we still don't have a phone ringing. Okay.
Let's see. You know, inspection is a combination of different activities and sources of data. The boom is required at this point is required to be able to do the precise inspection of certain parts of the leading edge system that can't be accomplished by other means. Due to either access or visibility, so you know there's a you know inspection starts with the pirouette that you may have be familiar with, which is a plan to rotate the orbiter's thermal protection system into view of the space station. I believe it's at 600 feet. So it starts with that, but that doesn't provide necessarily all of the data that's going to be required. Due to the fact that the critical damage size may be such in certain areas that you have to have more precision in your instrumentation and your imaging. That's where the boom comes into place. And so the boom and the sensor package that it carries are required to be able to complete the inspection for some of the areas of the thermal protection system.
Now, does that boom reach all of the leading edge and thermal protection system, particularly when it has to reach over the open door?
Let's see. I'm going to say the answer is yes, and I'm trying to remember, but I believe it does accomplish most of that capability, if not all.
Can I ask just one other question?
Sure. We're going to come back around.
Are there plans to put those sensors on the station arm or on the station in some position?
Not that I'm aware of.
Okay, thanks.
Not for first flight.
Todd?
Yeah, Dave, thanks. I was wondering what led you to the conclusion that there was no slack time reserve in the development of the OBSS? In other words, whether you have insight into the various deliverables and when they're going to be on dock at the Cape or exactly what it was that led you to make that or led you to that conclusion?
It was the schedules that were presented to us for the development testing and preparation that were presented to us by the Space Shuttle Program.
And could you elaborate on that schedule and what's to be delivered when and what the long pole is, whether it's the development of the sensors, the boom itself, or the EVA handrails attached to it? I'm sure it's not that, but What the real long poles in the tent on that item are.
Let's see. At a top level, and that's all I'm prepared to be able to respond to your question. It's both the integration of the boom and its supporting hardware, and the overall integration of the sensors and the data that they produce, and making that useful information.
And are any of those items, I guess, going to be delivered? And are they behind schedule for March on any of those items?
The schedules that we saw support March.
Okay, Todd.
Earl?
I was wondering if you could say what the range of critical debris size is as it's now been assessed, and also in the testing of the thermal tiles, there were 6 complete breaks down to the densification layer. What size debris caused that sort of damage?
Let's see. That's data that I don't really have available, and I'm not going to try to give it to you off the top of my head. We have had discussions relative to critical debris size. It does vary depending upon where it comes from on the tank, and it also may vary relative to the part of the thermal protection system that's impacted. But as far as the numbers and the data, I don't have that, and so I'm going to ask you to go to another source to find that information.
And I'll try and get you the right point of contact for that, Earl. Do you have a follow-up?
Well, one other thing. In the report, it mentioned that on the non-destructive investigation of the voids in the foam, that your techniques are limited to voids greater than a half inch, and it said that NASA currently believes that the largest defect will be produced will be less than a half an inch. So I guess I'm not quite sure what that means in terms of what value NDI will have.
Well, let's see. I think you there's two things there. I don't think one has to do with what size of debris can be generated by a void that's smaller than a half an inch. That's one question. And then the other one is that the size of or the damage size. The critical damage may be is not necessarily associated with that void size. So right now I don't think we believe that there is any critical debris that can be generated by a void less than a half an inch. Now, a lot of that is still being evaluated, but right now that's where we are.
Mark?
Thanks. You made a distinction earlier between the boom and the sensor capability and whether the NASA might need a fallback with Safe Haven. I guess I was sort of under the impression that there was a bit of a full court press on that within NASA to bring that to maturity. And so my question is, if they're doing that internally, how closely are you following that? And when would they, I mean, is this something they could bring up almost at the last minute, or is this something that you would need to see some months out if they were to say Safe Haven is now our fallback for inspecting and repairing if necessary?
Well, let's see. You know, first, by itself, Safe Haven does not meet the criteria for return to flight, because criteria for return to flight would say that you have adequately controlled your risk and your hazards to assure that you're not going to lose a vehicle or a crew. Safe Haven only takes care of the crew, doesn't necessarily take care of the vehicle. So, you know, in itself, it cannot be used as a rationale for flight that you have Safe Haven. That's why we're monitoring it, and that's why the agency right now is calling it a contingency capability. And so how it plays into alternatives other than the boom is yet to be seen.
Okay, I would like to ask a follow-up, or it's actually in a different direction, but the report, again, mentioned something that you discussed in your open forum about NASA having enough personnel to sort of address the work that's required to meet their planning for return to flight. I wonder if there was any sort of post-April meeting of evaluation of that amongst the board members, and whether you are more concerned about that, or whether that concern has been alleviated, and if it's about where it was, how does that play into the sensor development? Is that strictly a technology issue, or would more people focused on that effort actually help them reduce the pressure?
Let's see. The context in which we raise the issue is that it's not not yet of a problem, but is a concern that we have observed. And so right now I would tell you no, that not having people to be able to support the development of the boom and the sensor and its integration into the mission is not a part of the risk.
Warren?
Hi, Warren Leary. I guess I'm following up on Mark's question, I guess, and also Frank Mooring's. The CABE recommendation made no mention of boom and sensors. This is NASA's idea. CABE simply said a way to inspect and repair. Now, if the boom and sensors aren't ready, could NASA not just say we have a space station? Boom was first proposed, in fact, kind of as an autonomous inspect and repair capability. Now all the missions are going to the station. Can't you just say, you know, we can do close inspection with EVAs and not necessarily have the boom on the first flight?
Yeah, let's see. If you want to be successful and long-term in accomplishing what you need to do when you take the space shuttle to the space station, you're not going to be able to dedicate days of EVAs to go out and do the type of inspection that's required to ascertain that there is no critical damage. Therefore, the boom has become the primary approach relative to accomplishing that, because you can do it and determine critical damage without having to do an EVA. So the EVA is an alternative, but it's a costly one from the standpoint of being able to accomplish the overall objectives of the mission. Anytime you have to add an EVA or two to the mission, then, you know, to the nominal mission, then you start compromising your ability to do other things. So that's why the boom has become important. Clearly, if a boom's not ready to fly and a sensor package isn't, EVA inspection may be a possible alternative for a first flight. It's not something you'd want to do long term.
Right, just for that first flight. Well, again, you'll be doing everything else from monitoring the launch, monitoring debris from the tank, and all that. It would seem that you might be able to still do that with EVAs, granted, as cumbersome as it is, and do the boom and sensor on the next flight or a little later. That is a possibility, I guess.
Yes, that's a possibility.
Okay, Brad? Brad Liston, are you still with us?
Yes, I'm here.
Okay.
Sir? Back to the issue of the personnel drain potentially caused by the new Department of Safety and Engineering offices, is that something that that the task group sort of developed that concern independently, or where were you hearing that concern? Where was it expressed? Was it rank and file? Was it managerial level? Where was it coming from?
I think there's two elements of it. One is we've looked at the plans for some of the new organizational changes, including the NESC, the preliminary plans for the Independent Technical Authority. All those require a draw on resources that are currently supporting the space shuttle program to some degree. So we sensed that by looking at that, say, well, gee, you know, these are new activities. They require additional people to perform them. And that was substantiated to some degree by our discussions across the board with the people that we have had dealings with relative to our fact-finding that it could become a problem. Hasn't yet. I need to emphasize that it could become a problem, and it hasn't yet. My own personal observation is that the other risk to that is the exploration initiative. That too is going to start drawing on our the technical resources within NASA to be able to go off and begin that effort, which just intuitively tells me that a lot of the good people that will go and work that program may be good people that would come out of the space shuttle program or potentially out of the ITA or NESC. The agency, however, is recognized that they need to enhance their technical capabilities and is off working ways of growing the technical staff to be able to meet the challenges of the new organizational alignment and also the exploration initiative.
Thank you.
Okay. I think we have time to get at least partway through again, but before we do, let me ask if there are any other news media that have either joined us since we began that have a question that we haven't called on yet, or if Tracy or Gina have rejoined us. Okay, not hearing that. I'll run back down through, and if you have another question, feel free to ask it. Marcia Dunn.
Hi, can you hear me?
I hear you, Marcia.
Yeah, I had a follow-up to the boom yet again. Are you aware, Mr. Covey, of any technical alternatives that are being looked at right now that could take the place of the boom? Is there a backup plan, a part two that's being looked at that could sort of start development work and maybe proceed even quicker, something robotic, something that I couldn't even think of right now?
Yes, the answer is that there are alternatives to the boom and sensor package that are being looked at for a long term. The technical challenges there are greater than would support the STS-114 flight, which is our focus. But there are alternatives that are being looked at, including the use of robotics, free-flying inspection systems, and in the future we may see that's the way that that this is accomplished. Our focus is on STS-114. The primary method being assessed for STS-114 right now is the boom extension with the sensor package to be able to complete the assessment, the inspection requirements. So that's why we're focused on it and STS-114.
Okay, thank you.
Bill Harwood, do you have that?
Yeah, I guess. I mean, he kind of just answered it. But Dick, I mean, the boom and sensor can't fly after the Japanese module is installed anyway because of clearance issues. But what you're saying is you guys aren't even, you're not looking at AirCam or any of those things. You're strictly on 114.
That's right. We're only looking at those things that might be available to accomplish the requirements for STS-114. Not beyond that.
Well, let me then ask you this question. I'm just listening to you talk. I have a hard time, and I realize it's probably intentional on your part, but I have a hard time getting any sense of what you guys think at this point in time the likelihood is they can make March. I take it you say you don't see any their schedule show they can make it, but what do you guys think? I mean, do you think they're on track for making that, or do you think there's still a ways to go?
Well, see, I think the way we characterize it is that's their schedule. If their schedule, I will tell you that we believe it is a success-oriented schedule. But if they're successful, then they'll make it. We think there's risk just because it's a development effort, and there's always going to be risk in a development effort because you're doing something for the first time.
Okay, Bill. Dave Santucci.
Yeah. Somebody could go in a little bit more specifics about what the troubles with developing the boom are. Is it the software package? Are there specific sensors on the end of the boom that are giving you trouble?
Well, the sensors that are being looked at are not new sensors. However, being used in this application and being able to take the data and make useful information out of it that will give the true indication of damage is a software issue to some degree. It's an integration issue. It's the integration of hardware and software, and it has to do with, you know, there's issues relative to stability. You're talking about a very long arm when you put the boom on, so stability becomes an issue, and how you deal with that, either through the hardware or through software, is a challenge.
That's it. Thank you.
Let's see. Gwyneth.
I had a follow-up question to what Warren asked, and when you say that using EVA for inspection is a possibility, is that because that would be sort of the most obvious alternative, or is that because there's actual work being done on what would be needed, how many spacewalks, that kind of stuff, if the boom for some reason is not available?
I believe there's a fundamental understanding of what would be required in terms of EVA to accomplish the inspection if the boom were not available. And it's not necessarily it's not necessarily a preferred, well, it isn't a preferred way of doing it, because it does take, it will take time, but the methods and capabilities to do that are being worked.
Okay, Frank?
Thank you. If I could just push this boom issue a little bit more, is the boom considered a work platform for repair should it find damage that needs repairing?
Yes, potentially.
Now, that raises then the stability question. Has that been fixed?
Well, that's one of the challenges is if you have ever watched an EVA where a crew member has been on the end of the RMS itself, you know that it's a flimsy platform. You add another 50 feet to that, then the dynamics become even greater. And so, being able to effectively do repair with a crew member on the arm with the boom will be a challenge.
Is that a criterion for return to flight?
Being able to repair critical damage
off
is,
the boom, yeah.
Not necessarily off the boom, but being able to repair critical damage is a criteria from the standpoint of, and you can look closely at the CABE's recommendation, but it implies a best effort capability.
Thanks.
Let's see. Todd?
Thanks, Dave. Can you hear me?
Yeah, Todd. Hang on. Go ahead.
Okay. Colonel Covey, I got kind of two questions. The first is, what combination of capabilities do you see meeting the CABE recommendations on inspection and repair if the OBSS is not available for the first flight? And question two then is, how many EVAs does NASA figure it would have to do to do an effective inspection? And how much would that eat into already planned objectives on the mission, such as swapping out the CMGs and doing the various DTOs and whatnot?
Let's see. We have not dealt with the timelines of the mission and the impacts of specific alternatives to inspection and repair. And our focus is on the CABE recommendations for return to flight, which are pretty specific in saying you need to have this capability or not. So, how it's done and the amount of time that's taken for a particular method to accomplish those things, we have not dealt with so much as looking at can it accomplish the intent of the CABE recommendation. So I'm not prepared to answer your questions relative to time impacts and emission impacts.
Okay, if I can just follow real quickly. Have you looked at the, or have you been presented with various combinations of capabilities that NASA thinks would meet the CABE recommendations if the boom sensor package cannot fly? In other words, use of station cameras and EVA capability in lieu of. Have you been presented with packages like that? And if so, could you elaborate on their content?
No, we have not specifically been presented those types of packages. One of the things that we are doing, because of the complexities and the interdependencies of inspection and repair, is that internally we are beginning to address that from a
a little bit different standpoint because we want to understand all of the interactions, the alternatives, the way that that the different alternatives play together. But we're just starting that approach, and so far the program has not brought forward what I'll call as complete solution packages to us as alternatives. It's ongoing work, both on their part and on our part.
Thanks.
Earl Lane?
I guess I'd like to make one more run then on this question of whether you see a drop-dead date at which the program has to bring forward these alternatives and say we've decided the boom simply isn't going to be available. It seems to me they'd have to do that at some period, months or many weeks ahead of the projected launch.
Yeah, we don't set those types of decision dates and have not been presented any relative to the boom and sensor package.
Well, I'm just wondering, I guess, whether you have a gut feeling on your own on when that sort of decision would have to be made.
No, I don't. Mark?
Yes, I'd like to follow up on that point. If they stick with the boom and sensors, I'm wondering what sort of demonstration the task force would like to see. I mean, would this be more than briefing papers and PowerPoint? Would you want them to, I don't know if they could simulate this somehow, but do something fairly demonstrative to satisfy the different lines of expertise on the task force on this issue, or would it be something more straightforward, again, like just a PowerPoint presentation? Or just don't know how much fidelity they could offer you and how much you would require in a ground test or simulation.
Well, requirements for tests and certification of a capability are pretty well set by the program, and so we would follow along with the data that was generated from their testing, and whether that testing is through simulation, analysis, or other means, we would be privy to that data to understand the true capabilities that would exist with the boom and the sensor package as it was to be flown. So, whether it was anything special that we would require, no. We're not going to identify any special requirements beyond those that would be required for certification within the current program guidelines.
If I get a follow-up, too, again, on another topic, it has to do with the ITA. With the slipping of the launch date, do you think it's possible that they could actually pull this facet of the recommendations together, even though it's not required before the first return to flight, or
we do address that in the report. We very very specifically we believe that the space shuttle program and the Office of Space Flight will have implemented an ITA concept by later this year, prior to first flight. Same with the SM&A organizational changes and the systems engineering organization within the space shuttle programs already up and running, doing great work. So we expect that to some degree all of the organizational change recommendations will be in implementation prior to first flight.
Okay, Warren Leary.
I'll pass this off for me. Thank you.
Okay, and Brad Liston.
I'm good, thanks.
Okay, I think we're just about out of time. I want to check though before we cut it off to be sure that I haven't picked up any additional news media that have not asked a question. If not, the audio from this teleconference should be available this evening on returntoflight.org or tomorrow at the latest. We thank you all for joining us. We'll call this a briefing.